Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Get the comfort and support with a new mattress from Serta. Find the perfect mattress for a deep and restorative night's sleep. Take control of your sleep and save big money on Serta mattresses now at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money
at Menards. Good afternoon. Joining us on the line now is David Bellos. He's a writer, translator, and professor of French and comparative literature at Princeton University. He is the co-author of Who Owns This Sentence? A History of Copyrights and Wrongs. It's an exploration into how copyright has become a tool of unprecedented power and wealth for the few, widening the gap between the richest and poorest in society. Welcome to the show, David.
Glad to be here, Hannah.
Oh, it's lovely to chat with you. Thank you for joining us. So this is a really fascinating subject. I'm interested to learn a little bit more about the history of copyright. When did it come about?
Well, the usual story is that it came about in 1710. That's 314 years ago, in a thing called the Statute of Anne, which was a law passed to put an end to a period of chaos in the English book market. And what the Statute of Anne did was to attribute the ownership of printed books to their authors for 14 years after publication, renewable for another 14 if the author was still alive. But, of course, what authors did was they sold their rights to publishers, because without a publisher, you can't get a book out. And the publishers didn't respect that 14 or 28-year limitation. They thought that once they'd bought those rights, they owned them forever. And so it wasn't until towards the end of the 18th century that there was a big legal battle in the House of Lords in London that confirmed that the Statute of Anne meant what it said, and that publishers as well as authors lost those rights to the public domain after a maximum of 28 years. So that's when it began. And it began as a battle about who really owns books in general. And as you can see, with any 14 or 28 year term for new books, most of existing literature belonged to the public, had no ownership. So, I mean, copyright really, despite what some legal historians say, is really what happens is the creation of a public domain of books that belong to all and to everyone. But that's not the case nowadays.
No, I mean, you'd think that it should be fairly simple, and that obviously contracts are drawn up so everyone knows where they stand and everyone knows who owns what, and contracts can't be broken, and there we go. But it's not that simple at all. I mean, you can get people owning things or buying the rights to things that have no connection to the product whatsoever.
Well, that's right. That's a kind of a modern perversion. But bit by bit, over the course of the 19th and the first half of the 20th century, copyright came to affect not just printed books, but all written things, and then sheet music, and then paintings, and then photography, and on and on and on. Even in 1976, it was decided, for the purposes of the law, a computer program was a literary work, would you believe it? Which is why computer programs are now protected not by patents, but by copyright. And copyright sort of also, it grew like Topsy. You know, first of all, it was 28 years, and then it was 30 years, and then it was lifetime, and then it was lifetime plus 10 years, and then lifetime plus 30, then lifetime plus 50. And now it stands at lifetime plus 70 years. So anything you scribble on the table napkin now will belong to you and your heirs and descendants until the 22nd century. And also the range of powers that copyright gives us expanded greatly in the beginning and for a long time. It was really a tool for stopping people committing blatant piracy, I mean, reprinting books without permission. But now, when you own the copyright, you own the rights over all derivative uses of it. And all derivative uses, yeah, it includes, things on tea towels and any kind of, obviously translation, adaptation, abridgment, rewriting for the screen, rewriting for the stage, but even permission to quote little chunks of other books. Well, you have to ask for permission because the owner of the rights of the original work can demand a fee, just to quote a couple of lines of poetry. But all of this is a late 20th century thing. It had been happening in slow motion for 100 years before, but the big acceleration, the big expansion, comes in the last quarter of the 20th century.
So is it mainly big multinational companies that own copyright to a lot of things, or can individuals own the copyright?
Oh, individuals own the copyright to anything they create. However, copyrights in things that are actually worth something, like, have commercial value, belong in their vast majority to corporations. Obviously, that's true in the case of movies, but it's now truer and truer in the case of music, where big companies like Universal Music Group buy up the rights from the singer-songwriters whose music they publish or produce. The vast bulk of commercially viable copyrights are now not in the hands of individuals. I mean, even in the case of, take the case of the book that we're talking about, who owns this sentence, I own the copyright to it, together with my co-author. But in order to get the book published, we sign a contract that ascribes the exploitation of that copyright to the publisher for the natural term of copyright, which is 70 years after my death. So I hope it's a lot longer than 70 years. And I will never dispose of that copyright in my lifetime, and I guess nor will my children, because it'll go on belonging to the publisher or whoever owns that publisher or whoever buys out that publisher's license.
Interesting.
And that's unlikely.
Yeah.
And that's unlikely to be anybody who's got anything to do with literature or with that book or with me.
So going back to the music thing, so artists who produce their own song, produce their own music, that it's owned by them until a record company comes along and buys the rights. Can a musical artist, if they're not already, really well known, can they have success with their music without by maintaining the copyright, or do they need that big record company to come along and give them the money in order to propel them to stardom, as it were?
There are always exceptions. That's one of the wonderful things about the history of literature and the arts. There are always exceptions and strange corners where people manage things that seem impossible. But the broad and general answer to your question is that even in the age as we are now of sort of amateur videos, amateur TikToks and so forth, with a few exceptions, there are the gatekeepers, and to get access to a wide public, you need a company that's got the power to distribute your music. And so actually it's a tremendous gamble to try and reach a public without the backing of an organization.
So when you talk about the kind of power and wealth for the few, are you talking about the big publishing houses, both for books and for music and for films?
And the people who own the publishing houses, who are remarkably few because they're now such big conglomerates that belong to other big groups. That's right. The few, the shareholders, the equity owners of these very, very large groups that control a very large proportion of book publishing and music publishing, and, of course, proprietary software around the world, and most of them are based in Europe and North America.
And presumably that's just as people produce more content, books, music and films, these people are just going to get richer and richer and richer and richer. I mean, can you see that changing?
Not unless people now start reading my book and thinking about it and understanding a little bit about how we got into this mess, because it's not something, as far as I can tell, that anybody ever really intended. The history of the copyright laws seems to be largely a history of unintended consequences. I mean, the reason that computer programs are copyright is as silly as this. In the early 20th century, you know, there were these things called player pianos. They were automatic pianos that played when a piece of paper tape was put through a mechanical winder, yeah, and it operated the keys. And there was a great row between restaurant owners and the song publishers. On the one hand, they said, no, the paper tape is part of the machine, and we've bought the machine so we can play these tunes. And the music publisher said, no, the paper tape is a copy of the sheet music that we publish, and you're infringing our right. The solution to that particular squabble happened in 1911, the solution involved regarding a punched paper tape containing a musical notation as equivalent to a piece of published music. So I'm sure you're far too young to remember, but in the early days, in the 1960s and 70s, computers were operated by punched paper tape. So the analogy of the player piano punched paper tape to the punched paper tape operating those early computers was enough for courts to judge that a computer program was the same sort of thing and was therefore covered by copyright.
Gosh.
Isn't that silly? Nobody really, when the argument over player pianos, they had no idea that they were setting a precedent that would basically create the proprietary software industry 60 years later.
Amazing. It is bizarre, isn't it? So how did this book come about? Why did you decide to look into the history of copyright?
Well, it's all the fault of my co-author, Alexandra Montague, who's he majored in comparative literature at Princeton many years ago and has become an international intellectual property lawyer in the meantime. And he came back to Princeton and said, you really ought to teach students about this because copyright constrains literature, books, all the things that you're interested in. And so I picked up the challenge. I said, all right, well, let's do it. And so we taught a course together about copyright and the history of culture. And we got such a good response from students, and we got ourselves so interested in what we were teaching, we decided that actually it would be a good idea to produce a book that the students could read, because there's a huge library of stuff about copyright law, and most of it is awfully turgid and unreadable, and it's talking to other lawyers. We thought that actually ordinary people also ought to have some access to this and to actually be encouraged to have a think about whether they really want things to be the way they are.
And like anything, if people want change, there need to be enough people who want that change to happen in order for changes to be made. I mean, do you think it's possible?
Well, of course it's possible. Copyright law has never been stable. There have been amendments and new laws about copyright somewhere in the world pretty much every year since 1710. So it obviously can change. It does change. It never stops changing. The direction of change is, however, a different matter. So far, even though there have been serious attempts at various points in history to abolish the entire thing, every actual change in copyright has made it bigger and stronger and longer and deeper and wider. There's been no rollback pretty much anywhere that we've ever come across. So it's a tall order to imagine it could be rolled back, but that it could be changed, certainly, of course it can, and it will be. There's no doubt about that. I mean, it's such a ramshackle, rickety structure covering such a wide variety of different things that it's inherently unstable anyway. So it will go on getting changed. But I think before enough people can want it to change, enough people have got to start talking about it and start understanding just what it is. Sadly, I mean, these last 50 years during which copyright has been transformed, really, into a huge enterprise, there's been really rather little public discussion of it. It's as if people thought it was just a technical matter and not worth bothering about. And so that's why we've written this book, is to try and get people to understand it's not as technical as that. And it has real impact on everybody's lives every day. And you need to know a little bit about where it comes from to understand why it's the way it is.
I suppose we see members of the public, I mean, we see it happening more in music. You know, there's been various high profile cases over the years, band members falling out saying, well, I played that instrument, so I surely own that part, and all this kind of confusion, and people's songs or parts of their songs being sampled by rappers and things like that, or even questionable lyrics or melodies that people say, no, I wrote that melody many years previously. I mean, it's complicated, isn't it?
The saying in the profession is, you know, where there's a hit, there's a writ. It's because there's absurd amounts of money are involved. But I think we can genuinely regret the way in which copyright law has lent itself or has allowed itself to be to go down this rabbit hole of plagiarism and copy, because copyright itself is not about plagiarism. It really isn't. The word plagiarism doesn't occur once in the huge, long 1976 U.S. copyright law, nor does it occur once in the British copyright law of 1988. Copyright is not about plagiarism, but somehow the music industry, or at least the prima donnas of the music industry, have managed to make it seem as though any kind of imitation, similarity, homage is an infringement of copyright. Most of these cases fail, you know. Rather few plagiarism cases in the music industry reach a court with a jury that finds in favour of the plaintiff.
Fascinating.
And it's a vast waste of money. But people sort of, it gets into the news because they're famous people, everybody knows the names, but many of those cases are just plain silly.
Yeah. Well, if people want to find out more about copyright and its history, they must get a copy of your book. It's called Who Owns This Sentence? And the book is available on our website, tre.radio. It's by Alexander Montagu and David Bellos, who we've been chatting with today. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for listening to me. Bye-bye.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.